Welcome to the 24th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chat.
Welcome to the podcast for whom Christmas is just the day before the Boxing Day test.
So as well as getting excited about Christmas, what else has been exciting you over the last couple of weeks?
I did very much enjoy... Well, I enjoyed the whole of the India-West Indies test series. I thought it was a series that kind of exceeded expectations. But the final day of the final test was brilliant. It was interesting that at a time when the pundits are all sort of anxiously pondering will test cricket survive, test cricket just keeps coming up with these stunning games, you know, Australia, South Africa. And this final day, perhaps what made it so fun, was we'd had four really slow days of steady accumulation. This fifth day was supposed to be the end, a sort of slow end to a very slow test, a slow draw. And suddenly it just sort of exploded into a brilliant day's play. All three results were possible. Momentum kept shifting.
And it was a fitting end to actually what was a very interesting series. It was interesting to see some good young West Indian batsmen coming through, Adrian Brown
particularly. And I think the way the West Indies held it together on that last day, finally, I mean, they collapsed horribly at the start, but I think the way they held it together in the field and with the ball towards the end of the day would probably have given Darren Sammy quite a lot of encouragement.
And so Virat Kohli, was he the villain of the piece?
Well, it was very tragic. The moment after this game finished, you know, I hit the old Twitter, I think that's the technical term for it, and
at reverse threat.
It was at reverse threat, if you fancy a bit of informed conversation. Well,
conversation
like,
anyway.
Fancy a conversation about cricket. And it was interesting to see Indian fans instantly laying into Virat Kohli and Ashwin. And I just kind of felt it was incredibly harsh. You've got two young players here who Kohli played very well in stressful conditions. Ashwin, similarly, is a tail-ender who played, I thought, very well. You know, and to accuse them of bottling the finish seemed very harsh. I kind of missed out on the point that it was just a very good game, really.
Absolutely, and I think what's also been nice is that the excitement has continued into the one-dayers too, because you often get the sense with one-day series that they're sort of a bit after the Lord Mayor's show, and that particularly India are stronger as a one-day side at the moment than they are as a test side. Mm-hmm. And I certainly had a suspicion that they were just going to steamroller this West Indian side. And in a sense, Virendra Sehwag scoring a double hundred doesn't happen against the best bowling attacks in the world. That in itself has been very exciting. It's been interesting that this sort of magical 200 barrier that no one seemed able to surpass has now been broken twice in 2 years.
You kind of feel like if anyone, Sehwag, has the sort of had the capacity to do it.
Yeah.
It seemed like the West Indian bowlers, it got to a stage quite early on in that innings where they simply had run out of ideas,
yep,
ways,
yep,
to stop him.
Exactly. But I just wonder with that 200 thing, I was listening to something the other day that was talking about the 4 minute mile. And the fact that once that was broken, it's as much a psychological thing as anything. So maybe we can expect double hundreds to be coming thick and fast
on a sort of more regular
in one-day cricket. But what's also been nice about this series is that it hasn't just been about Indian firepower. The Windies, obviously, they won the third test. And altogether, I think they've put together not only... I mean, for too long have we talked about spirited West Indian performances, which basically means they were crap, but they tried. And it hasn't just been spirited. They put together very, very sort of sensible performances. Obviously, it's been helped by the likes of Ravi Rampal's 86 coming in the second one day when the Windies just were going to set no kind of a total. And he came in at number 10.
I think maybe even number 10.
Number 10 and really made a game of it. He then took four wickets in the next game, which is the one the West Indies won. And so even though some of the results have been heavily in the Indians' favour, I've felt that the series has been actually quite a satisfying one.
With Rampal, there's something particularly hilarious in the fact that, you know, West Indian tailenders for so long were the definitive rabbits of international cricket. And to see a West Indies number 10 come in and smash 86 in, you know, dare I say it, Sehwag-esque fashion.
But... So what have you been thinking about the other series going on at the moment?
Well, I have found slightly oddly named, well, it's not oddly named, it makes a lot of sense, but it doesn't roll off the tongue, the Trans-Tasman Trophy. I found that a little bit underwhelming so far. I think the first test was miserably one-sided, and I think New Zealand just simply didn't look equipped to compete with the Australian team. I think the real problem, though, the second test has so far been a real improvement, helped, I think, by a very lively track at Hobart.
Yep.
But I think
Chris Martin bowling. I mean, it's really nice to see Chris Martin back
chugging away
and
37
bowling
years of age,
well, yeah,
and still going very effectively. I think the issue I have, perhaps, is I feel like we should really still be enjoying a cracking Aussie South Africa series. And instead, this series, I mean, you've already used it, but the phrase sort of after the Lord Mayor's show, it already has that feeling to it. It feels like we're waiting for India to turn up in Australia, and we're disappointed that South Africa, Australia is done, and this series feels oddly in between.
And really, I suppose it's similar with the Bangladesh-Pakistan series that's going on at the moment, where... So we're recording this on Sunday lunchtime, and Bangladesh are well on their way to an
miserable
utter hiding. And it's all kind of very well to talk about, you know, the fact that, and particularly with New Zealand, the fact that Australia for so long refused to play full-length series against them and everything like this. And actually, these kind of series sort of confirm all your worst suspicions about, and only serve to dampen any ambitions you might have about the Bangladeshes and the New Zealands of this world coming
through. I mean, if New Zealand are going to have a chance to take out Australia, this is a great chance. It's an Australian team in transition, and they just don't look capable of doing it. And I find it really hard to get excited about this series. I'm really looking forward to India coming, but I've struggled to get excited. Now, you've been let down by something... Well, something slightly away from the cricketing field, I suppose.
Yeah, well, this is exactly what's worried me. So I'm sure anyone who sort of moves within any kind of cricketing circles has been similarly inundated with adverts about Graham Swann's latest DVD, Swanee in a Spin, which I'm going to put my cards on the table and say I haven't watched.
And probably don't intend to.
I've watched some of the adverts on YouTube. I've just been amazed by, well, not even amazed. I've just been slightly disappointed by the level of crap that he thinks he can.
There's something quite
get
sad
away
about
with,
England's Maverick turning into a massive marketing tool, isn't it?
And there is, and I just
cashing
think
that, in on the Christmas.
Yeah,
market.
Yeah, yeah. And I think there's a lot of interesting when I've seen Graham Swann speak, and when he's been interviewed properly, there's a lot of interesting stuff he comes out with, not least his comments about Test cricket, which were kind of very much, I think, blown out of proportion by the various, particularly by the BBC in reporting them. But it just seems to me to be a missed opportunity. And maybe I'm just being a kind of spoiled purist in thinking that we should have a good philosophical hardback tone from him on his thoughts on the beautiful game.
I think it's the extent of the marketing for it that's become slightly teased. And I think perhaps we're used to, obviously, England players... you know, being well-played professionals, you know, driving, you know, footballer-esque sports cars. But perhaps there's something about having it thrust in your face so much that's maybe a little bit uncomfortable. From the archives, and this week, Toby will be taking us to a few islands off the coast of Papua New Guinea.
Some of you might have seen the YouTube video called Cricket in the Trobriand Islands, Trobriand. We're going to call them Trobriand for the sake of argument. And these are islands which were visited by Methodist missionaries at the beginning of the 20th century in 1903. Methodist missionary went across there, and they decided that the way to sort of civilise the natives in the wonderfully Victorian way that we all thought of then... The thing to do to prevent war and civilise the natives was to teach them how to play cricket. And what has happened is that, unlike cricket when it was introduced to the West Indies or to India or to Australia or to any of the other colonies, was that what's happened in the Trobriand Islands that is entirely unique, I think, is that cricket has actually been taken hold of by the people there, and it's been turned into a local and an unique and an individual thing. So one of the problems that came when cricket was introduced to the West Indies, for instance, it was very much a British imposition until the West Indies were able to take hold of it. And then when the West Indies did take hold of it, they very much played the game by the game's own rules. What the Trobriands have done is they've recreated the game themselves, and what they've done is they've taken bits of their own culture, which they've put into the game. It sounds like a bit of a nightmare to play, because the home team always wins, and the teams can have an unlimited number of players, so there are counts of games where there's sort of 60 people on each side. There's also, in this very interesting YouTube video, there's some footage of them sort of seemingly completely random moments, moments that we don't usually think are very important in a cricket game, like a dot ball. They'll all just run off and have a sort of celebratory war dance of some sort. And I think what's really, really interesting about what's, as well as just being a fascinating video to watch, and there are some interesting articles online about it as well, what's really interesting here is simply the way that we think about cricket as being a very sort of pure, single, unified thing. And the way that cricket has become involved and has sort of combined itself with the local culture, I think, is absolutely fascinating.
Well, I guess there has always been this obsession with the laws of the game, haven't there? Mm. You know, this idea that there is a set way to play cricket that we hold to be true and correct, and that to kind of part the way the game has become globalised has generally meant spreading those laws out. Yep. You know, it's meant lots of countries buy into them. I guess what's exciting
it creates a standard, I suppose.
Exactly, and if you want to play in the global game, you buy into that. Yep. And I guess what the Trojans did, which is the entire opposite, is they took what they liked and crafted it into something that I guess a cricket purist would say isn't really cricket anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, the extraordinary footage is of entire villages playing against each other. But it's interesting, I guess, sort of from an anthropological perspective, the idea that, you know, societies exchange things with each other and then they remake them perhaps to their own needs. And what they wanted, you know, what they wanted was a game that could consume entire villages. And the idea that you contain, it's interesting in the sense that I think the comment with dance and music is really interesting because actually is what we do in 2020 so far different? I mean, the fact that we blare a batsman into the track, you know, bringing parts of other aspects of your culture into the game, sort of morphing them together to make it a sort of grand celebration is kind of what we do with sport.
And I think there's something actually very authentic about really taking hold of a sport and integrating it within your culture. I mean, it's what you see when you see cricket being played in a park, which for me is a very authentic way to play cricket. And actually, sometimes when cricket is less authentic is exactly when, as you were saying, across the world we have this kind of one-size-fits-all attitude towards the game.
I mean, it's really interesting because I think I've always found, I think a lot of cricket fans find the spread of the sport fascinating. You find it fascinating when, you know, I don't know, you read an article about cricket turning up in sort of Norway or cricket turning up in places you don't expect. It's always really interesting. But I think what makes this example really unique is this sort of reworking of the game. And like, in a sense, it's obviously quite like it's quite isolationist. There's no one's going to go and compete.
No one's
going
to go and tour to the Trojans.
Right, exactly. They've created something that's kind of quite exclusive. But obviously, you know, cricket's invention has, as you made the point with the West Indies, has always been a colonial thing. It has not always, but it's often been a colonial thing.
Well, it was spread very globally through
right, and in a way, there's something quite democratic about this. Yep. You're giving them the game and saying, I mean, this idea of it as a means of preventing war is quite interesting as well. I mean,
And we very much, I think, separate culture and the social aspects of culture from sport quite a lot. You know, we see sport as being sort of hermetically sealed and happening in a sort of different place to culture and society. But what they're doing is they're saying actually that sport is an integral part of society and it's a way of bringing together. So when the Methodist missionary went across in 1903, they used to do a similar thing, which was to basically play out the tensions between villages and things like that in ritual, but sort of play it out with weapons and have sort of mock wars.
And you would effectively relieve the tension through...
Exactly. Right. Exactly.
I mean, it's interesting because the connection between cricket and war has been there in the sort of Victorian ethic, hasn't there? Mm. Behind the game, people have often seen the qualities of cricket and the qualities of war. The qualities of sort of fighting and the qualities of war. Qualities of fighting and qualities of being a good cricketer as similar. I mean, it was something the Victorians admired about the game and kind of why it sort of so established itself in the public school ethos as well. Mm. I mean, I'm quite interested in as well this idea that you can relieve national tensions with it. I mean, it's interesting the controversy that you have when sort of Pakistan play India, I mean, is that an event that relieves tension or an event that exacerbates
tension?
Yeah,
well, exactly. I think it's just an entirely different attitude towards the game to the one that we have in general at the moment.
And do we know anything on how the sort of the longevity of this form of the game?
I don't know whether they're still playing in the drop-in. I've just been Google mapping them and looking to see if I can with satellite images to see if I can see any.
See if you can see any cricket stumps being.
But we can only. Well, all I can say is I hope so. I certainly hope so.
The pitches themselves must be fascinating places in itself. Yep. I mean, yeah.
I think it was just sort of anywhere that there was a bit of land that they could use. So, to the book review, and this episode, we are looking at Mike Marcus's Anyone But England, An Outsider Looks at English Cricket.
And this book has found itself on lots and lots of best ever cricket books written, it's found itself very well recommended, despite the fact it really stands in a genre of its own, actually, as a cricket book that really looks to, if not attack cricket, then certainly attack an awful lot about the game.
Very interestingly, it has emblazoned on the front cover of the latest edition a quotation from Christopher Martin Jenkins saying, it's a very intelligent book, very cleverly written with a lot that provokes thought, but I am uneasy about the way he has a go at just about everything cricketers hold sacred. Are you uneasy about that generally?
I think when we decided to do this book, I think I actually got quite excited because we read a lot of books that trumpet the beauty of cricket and revel in wonderful players. And when I heard about this book, I actually thought, well, this is quite interesting. You know, there's something exciting about reading a book that sort of challenges you. And it says a lot about the book that he puts that on the front page. It's something he's very proud of.
And so the general theme of the book is an American writer, Mike Marcuset, who is very much in love with the game, but essentially examining its history, its culture.
It's an important point to make, though, isn't it, that he is in love with. He talks very passionately about his love of the game, of watching the game.
He does, despite the fact that he spends a lot of the book making pot shots at a lot of things. Cricket's commercial nature, the fact that it's run by a bunch of wealthy white upper class males based in London.
This is the interesting thing, because perhaps if we were to dilute like a key thesis from it, it's this idea that cricket is run in a way that is run and has always been run in a way that is desperately undemocratic, is very clique ridden, and has never really had the interests of the games at heart. I think what's interesting is, particularly as he goes through his history of the game, he sort of gives you a sort of potted history of the game, he makes that case very persuasively, and it's not difficult to do. I mean, cricket has been run.
You do slightly think, tell me something new when he says that.
Right, and maybe, though, this is the issue, because what comes as something shocking, I think, to him is perhaps something that we know that that's cricket's origin. Mm. Its origin is deeply aristocratic in that sense. I mean, there's an interesting point how actually in its very initial origin, there was something quite radical in the way that cricket upper class people would play cricket with lower class people. And there's a wonderful quote in the book talking about how, you know, this would never have happened in France at the time.
Yeah.
You know, there'd just never been that consideration in
France.
But
at the same time, he has a very interesting argument throughout, which is that actually cricket is in a very big way a method of social oppression rather than social liberation. He came out with and I don't know if I entirely agree with it, but there's certainly a very interesting view that the idea of fair play and the sort of acceptance of the way things are, the acceptance of a status quo and acceptance of a result, is actually a means of sort of people not striving for anything. Mm. If you have to play well and it doesn't matter who wins.
I think one thing that the book does usefully in terms of looking at how undemocratic and the game is run is it does make you realise that there's a lot we've come to accept about cricket that is perhaps a bit unpalatable. Mm. I mean, is, for example, you know, the power, the MCC as an organisation, the fact that cricket sort of marquee organisation is this basically this fuddy-duddy kind of yep. old members club. I mean, is that an attractive aspect yep. of the game? I think he finds it very unattractive.
There are a lot of things that we take for granted, which it takes. And one of his central sort of premises at the beginning of the book is I'm an outsider coming in and I can see things that people who have been steeped in the game can't. And one of the things is absolutely the MCC. Another thing, quite interestingly, is his discussion of racism, I think.
Right. I mean, I think this was a very interesting angle. And he makes a really fascinating point early on when he starts talking about racism. He says he mentioned this to a colleague in the press box, actually. And the colleague just kind of said, oh, you know, I hate people talking about racism in cricket. And I think that sums up how a lot of people feel about it. They're like, this isn't really an issue in cricket. Yep. This isn't. And actually, I think it's perhaps the strongest section of the book in a lot of ways. He makes a very persuasive case that the way the West Indies have been treated throughout their period of the game has bordered on either patronising or frankly borderline racist. I mean, it's quite interesting. He looks at a lot of very respectable cricket writers and what they were saying about the West Indies in their sort of prime in the sort of 70s and 80s. I mean, this from sort of from David Frith even, their game is founded on vengeance, violence and fringed by arrogance. He called for sanctions against these bullies. You suddenly realise that the way the West Indies were treated when they became successful, there was a racial element to it.
There was a national stereotyping
right.
that went about the fact that they were sort of elemental and sort of inspired and ferocious rather than being, you know, sort of Mike Brearley type cricketers, for instance.
Cricket writers defined their success in a very different way. They defined them in terms of almost like sort of
a
natural, brutal abilities.
Yeah.
And I think what the book does usefully is it makes you look at some of those ideas and actually you rethink them a bit and you think, actually, that's not really an acceptable way and it's not really an intellectual way to write about. And I think it's interesting because he takes it all the way back to Leary Constantine and having to deal with a Constantine side, having to deal with a lot of abuse over bodyline bowling, when at the same time England were confronting the West Indies with those strategies the entire time. And I think he makes this point that actually, quite innocently, there's this racism sort of in the press box sometimes. But also, I mean, his discussion of, for example, racism encountered by black players at particularly playing at Yorkshire, that's the real case study he goes into. He paints a very sort of a picture that a lot of fans will find very uncomfortable to read.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are certainly sort of very, very interesting passages within the book. I would struggle to sit down and read the whole thing I'd struggle to sit down and read anything that was 500 pages long or however long it is in one sitting. It can be quite dense, and you do sometimes get the sense that he has, I mean, he is a self, I think I'm writing, he's say, writing
Marxist.
Saying he's a self-professed Marxist.
Yeah.
And you do get the sense for a lot of it that he does have an axe to grind. But if you can get beyond that, I really think it's a fascinating book.
And I think reading it, you will certainly find something very, very different. I think what perhaps disappointed me similarly is the fact that you're left, there's an axe to grind, but you're not quite sure if he offers a real way forward for the game. Debate, and as Shane Warne prepares to return to cricket, playing in the excitingly named Big Bash League, we ask, are comebacks always a bad idea?
Yes, I think they probably are. Comebacks are a marketer's dream, just as Warne's return to the Big Bash League has been. Well, the Big Bash League itself is a marketer's dream, isn't it? And often I think that there's a lot of style over substance in comebacks, and a lot of the excitement that's generated about them is just sort of the idea that, oh, we want to see Shane Warne again, so put him on a pitch. Very often these things, of course, go horribly wrong. And I think where they go wrong, it's not always just for the individual, but it's for the team as well. I seem to remember when during the last Ashes series, when Australia were getting absolutely hammered, and we don't obviously like to talk about that too much, but there was all this talk about Shane Warne coming back, and I thought, could there have been a bigger way of sapping the morale of the current Australia side if with these reports that they would have had to have hauled someone out of retirement, and it was the only possible way that they were going to succeed. So I think very often it's done for the wrong reasons, because it's done as a publicity thing, and it's done to sort of drag a team out of the mire. I think the other problem is that from the perspective of the player, often a great career is defined by the fact that it sort of ends well and neatly, and the player is in control of the end of their career. So you don't end your career by being dropped or by a horrible injury or by just being bad and your career naturally petering out. That you do it by being at the height of your powers and saying, right, this is the moment when I'm going to stop. And having a comeback inevitably leaves a messy end to many a good career.
I mean, I think it's inevitable when a player returns to cricket at an advanced age. I mean, we recently had, I think, Martin Crowe trying to come back to the game at 47. I mean, they're not going to be the extraordinary talent that they once were. I mean, this is bound to be, you know, this is the ageing process. Yep. This is something I'm sure Shane Warne is becoming increasingly familiar with. But I don't actually think that such a return tarnishes their previous greatness. I mean, the achievements are there, the memories are safe. I think it's also worth remembering that a cricketer's career, I mean, all sportsmen's careers are short. A very lucky player may get 15 years at the top of the game. I mean, a really lucky player may get 15 years there. And when they depart from the scene, that's it. You know, the thrill of competing at the highest level is never going to be replaced. There's never quite going to be anything quite like that. And see, you're literally ready to leap. But why not allow these players to soak up as many of these opportunities as they can?
Absolutely. I'm all for long careers, but a long career doesn't need to have a retirement halfway through. If you're going to have you can have a career for 15 years without needing to have a comeback. Just have a career that you don't stop. I think having a comeback is neither here nor there to having a long career.
Right, but I think that let's use the example of Warne, you know, as the example that prompted this debate. I mean, he's retired, he's gone away from the game and perhaps thought, well, this will be fun. You know, this will be an exciting opportunity to play in a competition in front of home crowds. And it's worth thinking about those crowds. I mean, we say a marketer's dream, but you are a, I don't know, 12-year-old Australian cricket fan who has never had the chance to watch Shane Warne play, and you have tickets to a game to see him play. That's thrilling, isn't it? I mean, that
not kind of the Shane Warne. It's a slight pale imitation of the myth that you're not, by a player making a comeback, you're not automatically recreating the myth and the player. It's not a way of kind of being able to allow everyone to see Don Bradman or something like that.
It's not, I would agree with you that it's not going to be perfect, but there's still going to be a huge number of people who take an awful lot of satisfaction out of it. I mean, going back to your previous point, I thought it was very fair, the idea of what did it say about Australia, the fact that they looked to bring Shane Warne back in. I, at the time, slightly controversially, as an England fan, I thought, well, what would England not want to see right now? Shane Warne. I mean, I thought that there is an argument sometimes for thinking that once a player gets this sort of, if you're good enough, you're old enough kind of
thing.
Yeah,
although I think there's a
if you're good enough, you're young enough even.
An element of sort of crisis tactics. And I mean, you see it actually quite a lot in sort of village teams where you always depend on this one person who comes back all the time. And the team never actually grows because there's someone who's going to come back and score such. And I think it would be massively negative if they said, come back. But I think there's a difference between that, absolutely, and the idea of the Big Bash League where he's coming back to play when he's basically manufacturing another opportunity for himself to play. There's a difference between that and the kind of firefighting option, which is a bit like when Brian Close came back to face the West Indies Quicks. And
I mean, I think perhaps 2020 has, I think 2020 has changed things quite dramatically, actually, in that I doubt Shane Warne could turn up and bowl 40 overs, but I'm sure he can send down 24 deliveries, which is all he's going to be asked to do in this Big Bash League. And I think perhaps it's going to change the climate in that I think a lot of older players are going to think, well, I can still have the excitement, still have the fun, but actually the demand on their bodies at 20-over cricket is just considerably less. And I mean, would you think less of Shane Warne if he goes and bombs in the Big Bash League? Not really, surely.
But then he hasn't really gained anything either.
But I mean, if he's gained,
and if he does do really well, he still hasn't really gained anything. Well done, you've taken a few wickets in the Big Bash League.
You think we'd respect it more if it had a better name?
Yes, maybe that's what the marketing should be turning their attention to.
Mm. But I think it's something, I mean, I'll certainly, with very little interest in this competition, will certainly be curious to see how Warne does. But I think maybe it will set a precedent for other players. I mean, this idea of my test career's over, my first test career over, maybe I can make something in 2020. Thank you for bearing with us once again. We will be back in 2012 when we will be looking at Tangled Up in White by Peter Roebuck, and we'll also be looking at the strange story of Kenyan cricket and, well, lots of other recent cricketing events, I'm sure. Have a lovely Christmas.